Today's Teisho will be on case 60 in the Blue Rock Collection, the Pien Lu, the Heikigan Roku. Case 60 is entitled Umong's Staff Becomes a Dragon. Engo's Introduction. Buddhas and sentient beings are not, by nature, different. The mountains, the rivers, and your own body are all just the same. Why should they be separate and constitute two worlds? Even if you are well versed in Zen koans and know how to deal with them, if you stop there, everything is spoiled. If you do not stop, the whole world will be dissolved, with not a particle of it left behind. Now tell me, what does it mean to be well versed in Zen koans? See the following. Main subject. Umong held out his staff and said to the assembled monks, "The staff has transformed itself into a dragon and swallowed the universe. Where are the mountains, the rivers, and the great world?" Secho's verse. The staff has swallowed up the universe. Don't say peach blossoms float on the water. The fish that gets its tail singed may fail to grasp the mist and clouds. But ones that lie with gills exposed need not lose heart. My verse is done, but do you hear me? Only be careful. Stand unwavering. Why so bewildered? 72 blows are not enough. I want to give you 150. I couldn't ask for anything more, you know. I just think that this has been like a perfect session. You know. First of all, we've had incredible, I mean, everybody will admit, you know, we've had incredible weather. It's just been astonishing. You know. Beautiful sunny days with a light breeze. Cool nights, you know, that's sleeping weather, right, you know, right? Cool nights, warm days, sun, beautiful, you can hear the breeze. This morning outside the Zendo, the dense orchestra of the birds, you know, beautiful, right? And yesterday while we were running around, this incredible thunderstorm and this amazing downpour. You know, so beautiful. So beautiful. Just amazing. And everybody's been doing such an excellent job. And people have been coming into the Dokusan room and you know, it's just like a dream come true. I care very much about each of you, and I want more than anything else for you to, I want more than anything else for you to walk this beautiful path and wake up, and then continue if you want to continue to walk it. I'm very happy when people are doing well with their practice, as well as everybody's been doing. You know, I've had sesshins where it's been amazingly different from that. You know, and there's bound to be sesshins like that, where, you know, one thing after another doesn't quite click, you know, and, you know, I had this one sesshin where, this person I mentioned yesterday in the story about the about the about my nose, the booger. You know. This woman came to our sesshin, and she was somebody who had, I guess you could say, like a chip on her shoulder. Anyway, she would always come to our sits. We used to sit at a convent over in North Brunswick. And it was a nice place, and they were very nice, the sisters there, on Sunday night. We would sit there. And this woman would come to sit, as she'd always be late. She was late, I'd say, I didn't want to say, oh, you've been late again, you know, I'd just say, so I'm glad you made it. And she said, yeah, I guess, you know, I guess I decided to come or something. It wasn't like enthusiastic, you know. Anyway, she came to a June sesshin, as a matter of fact, for 5 days. And it was all, it went all right. But then she came to this August sesshin, and she was she just had this chip on her shoulder. She was like mad. It was, and I would say, you know, during the Dokusan period, I'd say, please, during the Dokusan period, please don't get up and leave this room. And if you can help it, please don't use the bathrooms. So she would get up during the Dokusan period and go out into the dining hall and go in somewhere into the bunkhouse, even though I had asked her not to. So you could see there was a kind of dynamic unfolding, right? If I said, please don't do this, she had to do it, you know. And there are such people in the world. I've seen them many times, you know, in the Zen circles. So why is she here, you know, and why is she... You know, so every Dokusan would be like an argument, right? Why do we have to do this? Why do we have to do this? Why do we have to do this? You know, and it was like a fight. It was like she was trying to pick a fight with me, basically. And indeed, she eventually left. She finally, I said, well, if you're so unhappy here, you know, please feel free to go. And I'm not telling you to leave, but, you know, if you want to go, please go, you know. And that was at around 9 o'clock, and we broke for tea. And as we were, you know, doing kinhin, you could hear her car, the gravel flying as she went down the driveway, and she was gone. And, you know, I never heard from her again. And then other things happened at that sesshin too. There are a number of sort of problems that happened. There was another person at the sesshin who has been doing Zen practice for a long time, but who has never been doing Zen practice. So basically, this person has his own agenda, and these people exist in the Zen world too, where this person is very, you know, the person has made his own technique, basically, for doing Zen. And I'd say, well, are you working on the Mu Koan? And he'd say, he said, these beautiful, you know, I'm getting there. And I'd say, well, what are you doing? And he'd say, you know, he had an elaborate, you know, practice where he would basically sit on the cushion and think. And I'd say, well, you know, that's thinking. You know, that's not what we do in Zen. You know, it was hard for me to have a conversation with him because, he might come in and sit down on the cushion and say something like, I'm making this up, but he might say, everything's burning up in the furnace. Everything's burning up in the furnace. And I would say, what furnace? You know? Where? I don't see any furnace. What? You know, it's all burning up in the furnace, right? And I say, what furnace? You know, what's burning, you know? And it would be, next statement would be just like that. Red shoes in December, you know, and stuff like that. Really, I mean, after a while I'd get a headache. It's like, you know, and I can't, I want to help, but I can't help this person, right? And this person was just going to town, you know, with these kinds of, you know, And so anyway, between these two people, you know, it's like, and then other things were going on too. And you know, about day four, people started coming into the Gaudokusan going, oh, I don't know. I'm getting nowhere. I'm getting so, I think I'll quit. And you think, well, that's just one person. Ding. Next person comes in. Oh, I don't know. I'm having a bad experience, you know. I'm in a lot of pain, you know. I think about going, you know. Oh, well, I'm sorry, you know, blah, blah, blah. You know, and then next person. Oh, I can't get anywhere that's going. And the next person. What's happening to your phone? Nothing, you know. Nothing's happening, you know. So there have been sesshins like that, you know. And by the way, you know, the world is, you know, there's a lot of people out there who could benefit from this, but they don't allow themselves to do it, you know. We have sitting on Sunday morning in Blairstown, which is quite a beautiful place, and Jackie and Alex are responsible for that sit. And I got an email from a person who, I won't tell you his whole name, but his name is William something, right? And he sent me an email. He said, you know, I've been reading some of your teishos online, and I would like to learn more about Zen practice. So I wrote him back in email, and I said, that's wonderful. Why don't you come to our sit in, you know, you're in such and such a town. Why don't you come to our sit in Blairstown? And he said, I would like to do that soon, but can you describe to me how to do Zen practice? And so I said, okay, well, you know, sit on the mat, do this, and this. And then he said, thanks, I'll report back, you know. So he sends me a report back, and I said, well, that sounds good. And I said, but, you know, try doing this. And I said, why don't you come to our sit-in in Blairstown, right? And I said, because I can really be more help to you if you come in person. And he'd write these long, long emails describing his experiences on the on the cushion, and they were, let me just say, highly imaginative, you know. I keep saying, well, why don't you come? You know, why don't you come to sit with us? And I swear this is the truth. He said, can you send me? He said, I'm still wondering about posture. Could you send me? Can you, you know, do a video and send it to me or something like that? Really. So finally, the guy did come to one sit of Blairstown, but at the end of it, right? He showed up, I think it was at the end of all the sitting, and then we went upstairs and talked, and basically he let me know that he was deeply enlightened, you know, and then I tried to get him to talk about how he meditated, and he said, well, and I said, well, I said, would you like, you know, I tried to explain what we do. I said, you know, I was puzzled because if you're already enlightened, why are we having this conversation, you know, first of all? And eventually I said that to him, you know. He seemed to want something from me. So I said, well, are you interested in doing Zen? And he said, well, I've got my own method. And I said, well, what's your method? And he said, well, instead of trying not to think, he said, I think so much it jams up the works, you know. Really. You know, I just have no more thoughts, and finally it just all jams up. You know? Really, I swear. You know. So anyway, he finally kept sending, you know, it just went on and on. You know, so there are such people in the world. Another time this guy came in and he had heard about our group and he read an article in the newspaper about us and he let me know he was an enlightened master and he came to sit with us. He didn't actually sit though, he sat in a chair and looked at us while we sat. And he said, I do Zen Kabbalah, is what he said. Like I should know this. And I said, So anyway. Some sesshins haven't gone this well, and that's all right, you know. But this one has, you know, gone really well. Everybody's made a superb effort. And it's not always possible, you know, to have a sesshin where you answer your koan. That doesn't make a good sesshin, you know. That's not how I would define a good sesshin. I would define a good sesshin as a time when people are deeply practicing, you know, deeply practicing. I mean, if you you know, if you want to pass koans, that's one thing. But Zen is really about waking up, right? So please, if you don't quote unquote pass your koan, please don't be discouraged. Don't feel you know, things haven't gone well for you. You know, that would be a big mistake. I mean, in our culture, we take all of these courses, right? That have like we at Rutgers, we have 14-week courses, right? And you do certain tasks, and you get a feedback from your teacher, and the teacher says, "Oh, well done, you know, A," or "Pretty well done, B," you know, or "Not, you know, decently done, C," you know, and if you're, you know, motivated, you want to get those A's, you know, so you work very hard, and you get a feedback. Well, you know, if you think of Zen practice as being like that, it's going to be frustrating, because it would be like taking a course at a university, and basically the professor keeps saying, keeps giving you a new assignment, and you keep saying, "Well, when is the course over?" And you go, "Well, what does it mean to be over? You know, what does it really mean, over? You know, I question that. You know, I don't think there really is such a thing as over. You know, you know, that would be Zen, right? You know, over, it's never over," the professor would say. "You know, just keep writing those papers, you know, and I'll respond." So it's more like that, you know, crazy as that sounds. So if you, you know, I would be like saying to the professor, "Well, did I get an A?" I say, "Well, what are grades? You know, what are grades? You know, the important thing is that you learned, you know." Well, you know, you might say, "Well, that's good, but how would you assess?" You know, "Well, I wouldn't assess," you know. So that's kind of like, you know, the point of Zen practice is to undergo a deep transformation, and koans are an instrument, you know, are a method, you could say. Instrument's probably not the right word, but they're skillful means of waking up. There are different traditions have different practices, and ours happens to be koans. You know, basically, answering koan is not the right way to even think about it. You know, basically, we're trying to experience reality, and the koan is pointing to some aspect of reality, and you can experience that reality more or less deeply after a while. You know, imagine, because this is very, I mean, when you're in your early stages of Zen practice, you're learning how to experience the world in a different way. So when you're watching the breath, if you are watching the breath very intensely, at some point in the first couple of sesshins you have, maybe 2, 3, or 4 sesshins, you're going to have these moments where, you know, you do feel like thoughts are receding. You're in a kind of different consciousness. It's not self-centered. You're not thinking about yourself all the time. You're not so aware of time. You're not so aware of, your body disappears, or you feel like you're floating, or you feel like you're in something very deeply. You know, this is samadhi. So once you can start entering samadhi, you're really experiencing the world in a different way. You know, this you might feel like you're, somebody put it so beautifully, like your body's being dispersed into the universe when you sit on the cushion sometimes. And so that's stage one of Zen practice. And people who are in samadhi experience things like sounds or tastes or other even physical, their own physical sensations in a very different way than in ordinary consciousness. Things are much more crisp and clear, much more intense, and more often more alive, you know. And the second stage of Zen practice is being able to enter mushin. And in mushin, everything disappears, more or less. When you're in deep mu shin, the mu means emptiness or nothingness, and the mind's blank and dark. And in your very most concentrated moments, you know, you may be unaware of anything at all, at all. You know, for brief periods, it's just like nothing. And this is stage two of Zen practice. And eventually, you begin to experience the energy that comes with this state. There's this powerful life energy that arises when you enter this state. And now you're ready to experience the world like with different eyes, right? And it's like you'll read these articles. It turns out that some people lose their sight or never had sight as children, and then they can perform an operation and people suddenly have the ability to see who were blind. And the interesting thing about this is that when they have this corrective surgery and they can suddenly see, they can't see the world as you and I see the world. That's very interesting. They have to learn how to see. So one of the things they have a hard time with is depth perception. We actually, much of our depth perception is not provided by our eyes, it's provided by our brains. Even though it seems to be very clearly there, part of the visual world we live in, it's actually something we've created with our brains, not something that we experience with our eyes. So when people have this kind of corrective surgery, when they're given a real apple and a picture of an apple, they have a very, very hard time saying which is the picture, because both of the images are quite flat to them. You know, and even though we have stereoscopic vision, you know, even though the two eyes are slightly apart and it gives us a sense of depth, they can't see that. So they have to learn to see depth. See? And then they have to sort of educate their seeing to understand the whole visual universe. Now, this is very much like somebody who's learned how to enter samadhi and enter mushin. Now we can experience the world in a way that's not self-centered. It's non-dualistic, is another way to put it. We don't feel separate from the world. We don't start by assuming we're separate. We start experiencing our connectedness. We start by experiencing our connectedness with things. And we push aside or get out of the way all of our cultural prejudices and assumptions. And we start examining the world with fresh eyes. As I mentioned, you know, this is a little bit like saying to somebody who's just learned how to see, I want you to go find something out in the field. And we call it a tree. And the way we Zen people do it is we give them a kind of a hint. We would say, you know, roots, it reaches into the ground and reaches up to the sky. It reaches into, that would be a good koan. Reaches deep in the ground, up to the sky. That would be the koan. So we'd give this guy who's just had corrective eye surgery the koan, deep in the ground and up in the sky. We'd say, go out there and find something that's deep in the ground and up in the sky. And if he brought back a deer, right, we'd say, nope, nice try. You know, rock, nope, see, it's on the ground, but no sky, right? You know, so this is koan practice, right? You know, he might bring back a flower, and he'd go, okay, you're close. It's bigger, though, bigger, you know, okay. So finally somebody grabs a tree and says, my God, this is it. Could this be it? And of course, people have all kinds of psychological issues. Oh, this couldn't be it. I'll never win. I'll never find the tree, you know. I'll never find the tree. Why am I, you know. Okay. Or they find it and think, now this isn't it. You know, and they wander off and, you know. That happens all the time, right? How's it going to practice? Oh, good. Well, what's happening? Nothing. Tell me what's happening. Well, this. Oh, that's the answer. Oh, you know, and so that happens, right? You know, they found it, but they thought this couldn't be it. You know, this is just something. Who knows what it is? is a tree. So Zen is learning to see the world in this new way, and experience the world in this new way, I think it's just the most wonderful thing in the world. So if you aren't quote unquote answering your koan, today, please realize that that's not the point. This is a method or a means. And while you're out there grabbing deer or grabbing stones or flowers and bringing them back, you're learning more and more about reality all the same, you're developing depth perception. You're developing powers of awareness that you never had before. This is really very important, it's not like wasted effort, right? I mean, you're sitting on the cushion in deep samadhi, deep mushin, and that in itself is very transformative, very transformative. I mean, there are some meditation traditions where that's all they do. They just sit on the cushion in deep mushin, and just do that. So at the very least, you're clearing away illusion. You're sharpening your mental powers, and you're deepening your connection to the world, even if you aren't quote unquote answering your koan. But the whole time you're doing this, it's like you still are out there in the field exploring the field, And so all of this is like cumulative. It's cumulative. Little by little by little, your world of experience is radically transformed. And with koans, there's different degrees of an answer. There's different degrees of an answer. So koans can be answered. You could come in and say something that would just be incorrect. So if I said, reaches to the sky and deep up into the sky, deep into the earth, and you went out and brought me, there's a soccer ball out there somewhere. You brought in a soccer ball, that would just be like, I just have to say, gee, I think you're in the wrong direction. And I think this is not quite it. So there's an answer that's just not it. Okay. If you brought in a flower, it actually meets the definition, right? It's close. It reaches to the sky, but not very high. And it goes into the earth, but not very deep. Right? So that would be, I'd say, oh, you're going in the right direction, see? So there's differences of that kind. And of course, there's differences of, people don't always experience the object in the same way. So one person might bring in a dogwood leaf and say it's 10 feet tall and it has flowers. And I go, you got it! You got it, man! Okay. Another person might come in and give me an oak leaf and an acorn. Say, 100 feet tall. And dropping, these acorns. And I say, you got it. See, there's a variation. See, this is real. This is the world of koan training. So there, one person can find a dogwood, and one person can find an oak tree. There's that kind of variation. So there could be a little variation. There's also like degrees of clarity, or degrees of clarity is not quite the right word, but degrees of engagement. So one person could be very precise, like really hit the nail on the head. And another person could be like close enough. You'd say, okay, that's pretty good. I can accept that answer. So maybe somebody doesn't find an oak tree and they don't find a dogwood, but maybe they find, they wander into somebody's backyard and they pull out a sunflower and bring it in, you know. And I'd say, well, that's good enough, you know, that's okay. That's good enough. You know? There's degrees of precision in the answer. And all of this goes into, so this is what, if you wonder, it's not really a mysterious process in a certain way. You know, it's not. You might not, please understand, you probably won't understand why your answer is the right answer. You know, you probably won't understand why it's the right answer. And in traditional Zen practice, I don't think any teacher would ever say anything that I've just said. They would figure the more unclear it all is, the better, right? And that makes a lot of sense, because they want it to be purely intuitive. Just work with pure intuition, you know? And that's a good practice too, but I sincerely hope that I'm not messing anybody up, but judging from how well everybody's doing, so far so good, you know? So I don't think explaining things a little bit is going to hurt anything. There are these aspects to responding to a koan. Now, with the mu koan in particular, that's a very interesting koan, because it takes people a number of years of practice, generally speaking, before they can begin to find and the blank mind and return to it in a sustained way. I mean, if you have done Zen for a couple of years, and you've been sitting regularly, and you've been coming to Sesshin regularly, you might not feel like you've accomplished very much. But if you think about what kind of mental training this involves, it's rather extraordinary. I mean, first of all, a Sesshin, you are concentrating intensely for 8 hours a day. Now, you know, this is not much different in terms of the kind of intense concentration required from, say, like doing calculus, you know, really. I mean, it's not, you don't use the same part of your brain, it's a different consciousness, but you're very deeply, intensely focused for 8 hours a day. Now, when I used to do calculus, I would come away feeling unhappy, I have to tell you the truth. When I do Zen, I feel happy, you know. But some people love calculus. But this is difficult. In a similar, different part of the brain, but it's demanding, right? So in itself, what we're doing is very demanding. And then what you're doing cognitively is very different from ordinary consciousness. You're able to find different form of consciousness and remain in it for sustained periods of time. You're able to focus on an object over and over again until you enter a different state of consciousness. That's enormously difficult. To focus on a single object for 8 hours a day on and off. And then, even more difficult, you're able to focus on no object for 8 hours a day. Very, very difficult. So you know, mental training is quite significant by the time somebody can do something like that. But there's also this other issue with Zen practice, and that is the activation of the unconscious mind. And the mu koan is really requires years of practice, generally speaking. Now, if you've been doing the mu koan, I mean, it takes years of practice to get to the mu koan. So I'm talking, say, a year, 2 years to get to the mu koan, 3 years, in my case, 4 or 5 years. If you can get to blank mind, if you can find the blank mind and stay there repeatedly, not, you don't stay there for an hour, but you keep going back to it. If you can do that repeatedly during the day, then you're really doing mu practice. that you're really, that is mu practice. But as I've been explaining this week, you want to be able to dissolve the boundary between yourself and that awareness. So fusion with mu xin is crucial. This is why we do the crazy thing of calling mu, right? People come into the kitchen, the Dokusan room, and they call mu because I'm trying to gauge the degree to which they're able to put aside self-consciousness and unify themselves with the what we call blank mind, which is really the deeper part of your mind. And of course, as you know, when you're sitting on the cushion and you know your time to do Dokusan is approaching, you know, you might become anxious, you might have thoughts of failure or success, you know. You imagine, I'm going to go in there and I'm going to blow the windows out of the place, you know. Genki Roshi said, he once said to me, don't even show me your mu if it can't knock somebody over, right? You know. Actually, you can't knock anybody over with your mu, but he was trying to make it make me deeply engage with mu. So, you know, you have various thoughts and you might try to make it powerful. But the best thing to do is to just come in, enter blank mind, open your mouth and call, and it's an unconscious activity. It's an unconscious activity. And so your ability to surrender to the process or let yourself embrace the process and let yourself be guided by your bigger mind, by your unconscious, is crucial. And it's a bit of a judgment call when you've finished the koan. So some people can engage with mu xin rather deeply. Some people can engage with mu xin very deeply. So there's like a big opening. And after practicing for 30 years, it might seem like a hocus pocus. But you know, if you play the guitar and you've studied guitar, you can hear a master guitarist, you know, no question. You know, and you can tell instantly this is somebody who knows the guitar. This is somebody who is deeply skillful in the guitar. And of course, this is true with many things, you know. If you're interested in art, you know, you can pick up a piece of work by somebody and you don't know who did it, but you say, whoever did this was a great artist, you know. There's a quality of, and a depth to it. And so that's what I'm listening for in your mu. And I've heard, you know, I've called mu myself, and I've heard, I don't know, 10,000 moves or something, you know. So I'm listening for some of the qualities of a less self-conscious act. I'm waiting to hear the voice of your unconscious or your big mind. And it's amazing sometimes what happens. I mean, I've had people go, holy crap, did that come out of me? Really? And so... You know, that can happen. You can be quite surprised by what happens. You know. With the mu koan, sometimes a person can give an answer, the mu is pretty good. And then it's kind of a judgment call. It's like, well, we could stop here, or we could go on and I can see if this person will deepen his mu. See if you could even engage more deeply. And it's kind of a judgment call on my part. You know, sometimes there was one person who was coming to Sesshin not often, and then he decided to get serious about Zen, and he came to Sesshin, and he worked like the devil on this mu koan. It was like, huh? You know, because this is a guy who's been sort of, he's not here now, But he was a kind of person who was sort of on and off in his practice. You know, he'd come for a while and then he'd disappear. And then he'd come for a while and he'd disappear. And this went on for years. You know. And then I think he came to one sesshin and then no sesshin for a year or two. And then he came to a sesshin, and all of a sudden it was like he was working like the devil. I'd come in here and he'd be doing the extra sits. You know, he'd be sitting. And I thought, holy smokes, this is fantastic. So he was coming in and giving me moo, 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 moo. And it was getting better and better. Anyway, he came in to see me, and he came in and he presented, but it wasn't quite there yet, you know, in my opinion. And then after the sesshin, he said, you know, I went out in the woods and I called moo, and it blew my mind, you know. And I said, well, you know, I wish you could have come into the Zen, maybe next time you could come into the Zendo, I mean come into the Dokusan room, and maybe that'll happen again. And he said something like, yeah, well, yeah, maybe. And then he didn't come to another sesshin. So I must have let him down, you know, I must have discouraged him. So maybe I should have just said, you know, that's good enough. It's a judgment call. I want to encourage people, but I'm trying to get a deep engagement. I'm trying to get people to be very deeply in Mushin. And if you can live with Mushin at the center of your life, or at least more at the center of your life, you're going to be a very different person. You know, Zen is about experiencing the world in a very, very different way, if I may say so. Zen, you know, if you do Zen, after a while your experience of the world is going to be quite different. I don't mean to say you won't see cars on the road or you'll see ghosts running around. That's not going to be the case. But your world is going to be much more complete, much bigger, and much richer than the average person. That's a truth. You know, somebody wanted to talk to me yesterday after one of the afternoon sits, and we went out in the back there by the trees. And everything was so, all I can say is, and I'm sure you've had these experiences too, you know, everything was so intensely alive, it was astonishing. You know, I sort of caught me off guard. And it was hard for me to concentrate on what this person was saying because everything was leaping up. You know, the grass and the trees and everything were just so alive. It was just magnificent. You know, and when you have these experiences, you realize this is what life could be like. You know, life can be like this. Somebody else told me something. He said, he said he was feeling this incredible deep sense of connection. And he said he walked outside and he looked at the trees and some voice in his mind said, it's been a long time since I've been here. Like his unconscious said that, you know. And then he said, well, when? When was I here before? You know. Now this isn't going to turn into a spooky story, you know. The point is that this is like primal consciousness. It's, we say, original mind, as a matter of fact. This is like your primal consciousness. Don't be discouraged if you haven't entered your koan, because this is a long process, and every step of it, I think, is quite beautiful. When I first started doing Zen, I would sit once a week. I'd go to the Wednesday night sit with Genki Roshi, and then afterwards I'd meet my friends and we'd go have a big glass of beer. And when I'd get up, my brain was foggy and it undid all the good things done by the sitting. And after a while, I started sitting more often, and then, as I said, I went to sesshin. And my first sesshin was really difficult, but when I came back, I had a little taste of this, a bigger mind, this richer way of living, of experiencing the world, not in ideas, but in real experience. And I've been hooked on this, and I've been doing it for 30 years, you know. Because when I started doing Zen, I used to get up like late in the day sometime. I didn't get up at 4 o'clock or 4:30. And I have to tell you, I didn't really like, sitting for 8 hours with my knees killing me. You know. But if you keep walking this path, it's really quite extraordinary what kind of a change it will make in your life. And the key to that is putting mu at the center. Mu is everything. You know, it's the door to the Buddhas, you know, it's the door to enlightenment. And the interesting thing is, you know, when you go deeply into mu, you know, and then you walk outside, everything is just screamingly alive. If you think about it, what we have done in our world, our modern culture, is make everything, in my opinion, we've made everything dead. Everything is a lifeless object, you know? We don't treat trees, for example, as living beings. We treat them as, we say, you know, this is timber. Animals, you know, if they're not our pets, often in livestock cultivation, like hunting magazines talk about the annual deer harvest. You know, it's like harvesting deer. You know. We have a tendency to treat everything as an object that's a lifeless object. This is maybe a human tendency, but I think our culture has carried it to an extraordinary extreme. We talk about human beings as consumers, you know. I don't think a human being is a consumer. I think it's a very ugly image of a human being, in my opinion. We've built a whole culture around creating lifeless objects and replacing, eliminating things that are alive and putting things that are not alive in their place. You know? And I think we do this because actually we take living things and wipe them out and put dead things in their place, objects, and we're fascinated by objects. You know, a computer is not alive in the same way as a tree. You know, a little machine that moves around and talks is not a living creature, in my opinion. And we can't tell the difference sometimes because of our mental way of life. We're so cut off. We're so separated. This koan is about how not to let that happen to you. This koan, in the Zen tradition, it was often the case that teachers carried a staff, like a hiking staff. And he walks into the Zendo and he says, you know, you might think this is a lifeless object, but that's because of your consciousness. You've allowed yourself to be separated from the universe, so much so that things just seem to, even, you know, in our world, people even seem like objects. We often treat people as an object, right? I mean, yesterday I was talking about the way people are made to feel bad about the forms of their body, you know. That's treating people, that, you know, that's called objectification, but people don't understand what that really means, you know. The body is like sacred. It's a door into nature. It is nature. It's the place where nature begins, you know. We don't normally have that relationship to our bodies because we don't have it with anything else, you know. So anyway, Zen is, I think, this is a superior way of life, even if it's difficult to get up at 4:30 in the morning, and even if your legs are hurting, because I think this is like this turns the dead world, brings the dead world back to life. And I think that if you practice Zen, and if you put Mushin at the heart of your life, you become like the servant of life. Is that this whole thing is like a celebration of life. You know, we are surrendering ourselves to the living universe and reconnecting ourselves to the living universe. And I just think there's nothing like it. I think this is the most, for me personally, this is the most amazing thing I've ever seen. Because indeed, you know, I feel so alive. And I walk outside and it literally, it's like mind-blowingly beautiful. And that won't happen to you. You know, you could do a little experiment, please don't. But just watch television for 8 hours a day and walk outside. Really. And it's like crazy, you know, to do, there's a guy named Bill McKibben who actually did this. He said, I'm going to lock myself in a room and watch TV for 7 days. And he said, here's how my mind felt after that. But you know, actually this is what people actually do. They don't, you know, do it for like, you know, dawn till dusk, but over time, you know, you allow that to create your consciousness. And I think it makes an inferior way of life. I think it makes an inferior, a lifeless world. And when humans are cut off from the world, they take it out on the world, you know. So anyway, I personally think this is just one heck of a way to live. And I thank everybody for doing such a great job and for helping to sustain the life of this world, actually. And anybody who thinks that we're not doing anything sitting on a cushion doesn't understand our problem, which is really all... Our world's problem is really a problem of consciousness, in my opinion. And it won't be solved until people change the way they look at the world, they experience the world. You know, fuel-efficient cars are a good idea, but that isn't really the problem. It's much deeper than that. So thank you. And we have some precious time left. Please go deeply into Mushin and experience this amazing world, this amazing life. Every part of it's alive. Umon, this is a Master Yunmen, Master Cloud Gate again. Umon held up his staff and he said to the assembled monks, when you are in deep Mushin, the whole world comes to life. And when the whole world comes to life, nothing in it is not alive. See? And he says, everything has it. Mountains, rivers, and your own body are all the same, all one. This is one life. So let's enjoy it.